From 90.9 WBUR, I'm Deborah Becker. This is Radio Boston. Coming up, a look back and a look ahead at civil rights issues in Massachusetts in 2016.
While we don't have sort of some of the incidents we've seen around the country, I don't think that should lull us into believing that we don't still have a systemic race issue here in Boston.
Also today, we review the year's top stories in cybersecurity, from the Democratic National Committee hack to the FBI versus Apple fight over unlocking an iPhone.
It's fetishizing our phones above every other value.
Plus, the band behind David Bowie's final album, Black Star. All this coming up on Radio Boston. Stands a solitary candle. First, the news.
Thanks for listening to the Radio Boston podcast. If you'd like to support WBUR, go to radioboston.org and click the pledge button in the upper right-hand corner. Okay, back to the show.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Deborah Becker. All this week on Radio Boston, we're having conversations reflecting on 2016. We're talking with key thought leaders about things such as politics, pop culture, food, and art. And today, we're going to look at the year in civil rights. We're joined in studio by Michael Curry. He's president of the Boston branch of the NAACP and a member of the National NAACP's Board of Directors. Great to have you back, Michael.
Great to be here.
So let's start with a topic that you've talked a lot about, and that's the pilot program for Boston police officers to wear body cameras. This program in the works for more than a year, and then it was delayed after no police officers volunteered to be part of the pilot program. In September, the program did begin.
Right.
And we're about halfway through this six-month program. Where do we stand right now? Do we know enough about it to say whether it's working or what's happening there?
Well, it's interesting. One is, as a student of history, I reflect back on the fact that you've had external or advocacy groups push legal or government entities to do the right thing. And I think about all the advocates that had to push this mayor and this police commissioner to consider the adoption of body cameras. And you've seen their rhetoric around this change over the course of the last year. I think one credit to the city for adopting a pilot, but it can't be the end all be all because this was never about just adopting a pilot. This was about full adoption of body cameras. That's where the real fight is that we've gotten a pilot. The reviews of the pilot are mixed at this point. The cameras malfunctions with the equipment, the two vendors that they've used. But the challenge going forward is going to be, how do we wrap this up? How do we analyze the data and then start preparing for that full adoption?
Well, you know, you mentioned some of the reservations on the part of Police Commissioner Evans and Mayor Walsh. Let's listen to something Mayor Walsh had said about the pilot program. He was on our show in September after the court upheld the implementation of the program. Here he is.
Body cameras can't build trust in a community. What builds trust in a community is actually interaction with the community, with what young people in the office, in the community. You can't have interaction through a camera, and you can't have it. You have to have it through dialogue.
So that's Mayor Walsh talking about the pilot program for body cameras. What might the data suggest thus far? Do we know whether these cameras, because that was also from the commissioner. He said this could hamper police interactions with the community. People might be afraid to interact with officers, or officers afraid to interact with members of the community. Do we know whether the cameras have had an effect in that regard at all?
Well, we know the data is evolving. And I think, as we saw in a Department of Justice report that I brought to the police commissioner and his command staff to take a look at, and that there are other reports that show that these are having positive effects across the country, reduction in use of force incidents, reduction in complaints against police officers. In fact, in many cases, they back up the police officer's view of what happened on the scene. It could be used for training and evaluation purposes. There are way too many uses that we're not talking about, and then we can work our way through the privacy concerns. So like the mayor, I don't believe it's the end-all be-all that we just have body cameras and we fix all of this, but it's part of the solution.
Hmm. You know, we did speak with former Boston Police Superintendent Daniel Linsky as well about the cameras, and he objected to what he described as the singling out of police officers as being responsible for significant racial discrimination. We should say we spoke with him, too, about out and Supreme Court, Supreme Judicial Court ruling. But first, let's listen to what he said about police officers, because I think this is on a similar theme. Here he is.
The majority of police officers do not leave the police station and intentionally racially profile. However, we've got a system, as the Reverend pointed out, that deploys more police officers to communities of color, and we deploy them in a more aggressive fashion.
So that's former Boston Police Superintendent Daniel Linsky. He says the issue of racism is a community-wide issue. It's not just something that has to do with police. What's your response?
Yeah, Dan and I have had this conversation. I always appreciate every opportunity I have to sort of engage him on these issues. I think the real issue is this. We give extreme deference to police officers, right? We give them a badge and a gun, and we pretty much go with whatever version they share with what happened at a scene. With to whom much is given, much is expected. Mm-hmm. And the reality is we are building in transparency and accountability to make sure that officers, as we see playing out across the country, can't lie or won't make up the circumstances on the scene of an incident. And we're seeing that that is happening. And I mean, Dan could say that 95%+ walk out of the police station and they don't have an intention to racially profile or to discriminate, but I don't know what that figure is. I don't think he knows what that figure is, and I think part of the way to get there is with the increased transparency.
Mm. Now, I want to bring up the fact that we were speaking with him about a Supreme Judicial Court ruling that came in September. Essentially, the court said black men who try to avoid police and flee may have a legitimate reason to do so and should not be automatically deemed suspicious. Now, this made national headlines. This is quite a statement for a major high court in a state to make. What do you think is really the most tangible, I think, effect of that ruling?
Yeah, so what, I mean, again, it's one of the arguments around diversity in your courts, right? Because mm-hmm. we see in SJC, really under Governor Patrick, the diversity of our Supreme Judicial Court. With that diversity comes diverse perspectives, diverse ways of looking at the law. And what we saw here was a case where the court came down and said that it is reasonable for an African-American man or woman, based on the racial profiling that we're seeing play out, and they particularly pointed at the field interrogation observation stops that show a disparity in how people of color are profiled, if you want to use that term. I think it's an appropriate term. And that may prompt you to run. It may not be an indicator of guilt of a crime, but it may prompt you to flee. And I think that that's something you're going to see start to play out across the country.
You know, I've done a lot of stories about this, and I hear many people say we're so lucky in Boston. It's so different. Many of the horrible headlines that we're seeing from other parts of the country, those kinds of things don't happen here. True or false?
It's false for the most part. I think in college, when we used to do this work to get to increase diversity, we use the phrase the best of the worst, that you have a college that's doing better than other colleges, but it's nearly not good. It's not the standard. I think when we talk about these police issues, that phrase applies here. We have a situation where there is discrimination within the police department. I have police officers who point out discrimination in terms of how they're treated. I have citizens who come into our office who file complaints with us about police abuses. This city is not as bad as some other places, but it should concern all of us, and we should be working to try to eliminate that.
Boston Mayor Marty Walsh started conversations this year about, he says it's a year-long project to discuss race. Do you think that this will help?
I think it will help. I think, you know, part of any solution starts with the conversation, right? It's to assess where we are as a city and then to start figuring out what needs to be done. So I think, you know, credit to this mayor facilitating these conversations. The only thing I've cautioned his administration is make sure they're open. Make sure that you're not trying to sanitize the conversation. As one of his attendees said to him, that you have to allow for a conversation where people are upset and people walk out not necessarily feeling good, because that's a true conversation about race in this country. So I'm hoping that he allows for the true experience of a conversation that is both revealing and ultimately healing in terms of racism in Boston.
If we go back just briefly to the subject of police, we also had the issue of social media and police. Boston police say they want to invest $1.4 million in software that monitors social media. Critics say this could threaten civil liberties and, again, potentially discriminate against people of color. You know, we spoke with Arlington Police Chief Fred Ryan about this just last week. His town did adopt a social media monitoring system 2 years ago. Let's listen.
It's our position that it would be irresponsible not to have some software program to enable us to be situationally aware of the conversation that's occurring in publicly facing social media posts in our jurisdiction.
So, Michael Curry, what's your take on that, that police need this software to be able to monitor social media because it's such a big player and could potentially provide evidence that could help in solving crime?
I think with the heightened concern we have for terrorism, civil liberties tend to erode when we're at extreme heightened fear. I think that's what we're starting to see play out across the country. And even though the incidents of terrorism are less rare here in this country, we are also feeling what the rest of the world is feeling. For us in the NAACP and ACLU and other organizations, there is deep concern with the use of this collection of data from social media. We already know that law enforcement can abuse those things when they're not checked, when the process and the policy doesn't have restraints. So we want to be a part of that conversation to figure out what this looks like. And then, I hearken back to a city council hearing where city councilors in Boston said we could better use this money for trauma response and for youth hiring, almost in line with the mayor's comment that the systemic issues aren't really about what's being said on social media, but what's driving people to commit crimes and to act in ways that are not in keeping with the law.
Remind us, where does it stand right now in terms of Boston Police and monitoring social media?
Well, I know that they've gone ahead and moved forward with the $300,000 of that $300,000 coming from the federal government, and they're looking to select a vendor to provide that data, that access to the data. I know that we are engaged with the city council and others to be a part of that process. This process should not move forward without community involvement. We should be a part of that conversation. And that's really the critical ask from the ACLU, the Boston NAACP, and many others.
Mm. I want to just go back briefly to the state's highest court again, because there have been other things that have gone before the court this year that have been very important, mainly drug lab cases. The court is currently considering what to do with cases that may have been affected by former state chemist Danny Dukan, whether they should dismiss all of those cases because the drug testing that was to be used as evidence was compromised by her. At the same time, the backdrop to that is there are hearings going on in Western Massachusetts for another chemist who worked at the Amherst lab, Sonia Farrick, and she apparently was using many of the drugs, personally using the drugs that she was supposed to be testing. So obviously what happens with those thousands
Absolutely.
Of criminal cases? So this is going on in Massachusetts, and we haven't figured out a way to deal with these cases. What's your take on this? Do you think the high court needs to intervene here and say to district attorneys, this is what you need to do with these cases that use that evidence?
Yeah, I think the high court has been involved with various aspects of this case dating back 2-3 years now.
Right.
So I think the challenge for us going forward is, how do we make sure that people who've been convicted of a crime that was based on tainted evidence by either of those two young women, that the person gets justice in that case. And it may not always feel good, right? Because we'd had one incident where a young man got out after it was found that he had the sample was a Dukron mm-hmm. sample and he committed murder, right?
In Brockton. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So, ultimately, that's not the goal is to make sure that people go through the system and that their evidence isn't tainted, as we use the term in law, the fruit of a poisonous tree. That folks aren't have a fair process through our judicial process. And I think that, Dukron is an example where the Supreme Judicial Court absolutely needs to weigh in and be a part of this conversation and make sure that every person whose sample was reviewed by her and Farrakh is reviewed.
And what about the Farrakh cases at all? What about those? I mean, in that case, we're talking about prosecutors under former State Attorney General Martha Coakley, and whether those prosecutors, in fact, covered up some of what may have been going on here.
Yeah, so this feeds to a broader conversation about conflicts between the relationships between prosecutors, labs, DAs, offices with police. I think one of the conversations that I hope will come out even through a legislative process is the conflict of interest that exists within our judicial process, our criminal justice system. As we talk about criminal justice reform, this is a great place to start because there's a taint in how we do justice in this country, and particularly in this case in Massachusetts. So I think the prosecutors need to be looked at, the communication. As we saw in one of those cases, the prosecutor had a regular conversation with the lab, with Ducron in that case. That's concerning because this needs to be impartial. There needs to be a system that prevents this from happening, and it's not happening as of today.
If we look forward to 2017 with a new president who will be responsible for appointing number of judges, 103 across the country, according to the Washington Post, how do you think this will affect Massachusetts most significantly?
Yeah, you know, I think one is I met with the U.S. Attorney's Office recently, and I had a chance on the heels of the Boston Latin School finding where they found a civil rights violation. And one of my concerns that I expressed to them, but it would be a concern I expressed to the FBI and any other, is how does the election of Trump impact the investigations that we so earnestly want them to pursue? And there is a concern there because, again, this BLS case, as an example, if
Boston
this were
Latin
Boston
School.
Latin mm-hmm. School under Trump may not have been investigated.
Really?
Because there is a tendency by the whoever your attorney general is to send a tone for what kind of investigations will be followed or looked into. And I think that we have a concern, and we know that the folks here in the U.S. Attorney's Office, we live by the fact that when we call them, they will investigate it. They'll be thorough. But then they have to eventually to sort of seek approval from the higher ups when there are certain cases. And I wanted to make sure, and the NAACP is focused on making sure that a Trump administration doesn't impact that. Mm.
And of course, we know Carmen Ortiz is leaving as U.S.
Right.
Attorney for Massachusetts. She just right. announced that, which she would have done anyway. But that's what you're saying.
Absolutely.
The person installed in that position is going to have an enormous effect on which cases go forward.
Absolutely. We find often in our cases of civil rights violations or discrimination cases that it is a discretion by folks in those positions to not pursue these cases. That is concerning for us, and the appointment of Jeff Sessions is really troubling to all of us across the country who are fighting for civil rights.
You will be leaving your post as president of the Boston branch of the NAACP January 1st.
Yes, I will.
Your successor, Tanisha Sullivan?
Attorney Tanisha Sullivan.
Mm-hmm. She investigated allegations of racial discrimination at Boston Latin. So what's next for you?
Well, I've been on the national board for 3 years. So I've been told by the chairman to expect a leadership role on the national board. I'm serving as vice chair to William Barber of Moral Mondays on the Legislation and Political Action Committee. And I just got appointed to be chair of that committee. So that'll take some work. We'll be working on repairing the Voting Rights Act, the criminal justice reform across the country, and a whole host of other issues that we've been fighting for. And now there's a significantly higher challenge now under this incoming administration and their record around civil rights. So we'll have some work to do.
Do you think you'll stay in Boston?
Oh, yeah. I'm born and raised here, and my heart is here. So I'll be traveling a lot. But I'll still be around and supporting Tanisha and others and the ACLU and other organizations that I've given my time to. I'll continue to work with them.
Okay. So we'll know where to find you.
Yes, absolutely.
Okay. Thanks so much for coming in.
Thank you.
Michael Curry, president of the Boston branch of the NAACP and member of the National NAACP's Board of Directors. He's been helping us look back on the year in civil rights. Stay with us. There's more ahead. I'm Deborah Becker, and this is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Deborah Becker. President-elect Donald Trump named his Homeland Security Advisor today. He's chosen cyber expert Tom Bossert. Bossert is currently a fellow at the Atlantic Council and was a former national security aide to President George W. Bush. If the events of 2016 tell us anything, Bossert will likely have a lot on his plate when he takes the job. Joining us to look at some of the big cybersecurity news this past year and what news will continue to resonate in the year ahead is Bruce Schneier, a security analyst and fellow at the Berkman Center for Internet and Society at Harvard. Bruce, welcome to Radio Boston.
Well, thanks for having me.
So first, what do we know about Tom Bossert and the role of Homeland Security Advisor?
Yeah, it seems pretty informal. I actually don't know him. I looked him up. He seems okay. And I looked up who our current Homeland Security Advisor is, and there is one, and I forget the woman's name. So that should tell you that this is an informal role that hasn't been in the press much. You know, I'm going to assume it's going to advise the president on these issues, but more, I don't know. And we know this about presidential advisors, that their stature in the administration depends a lot on personalities and a little less on job titles. So a lot of this is let's wait and see.
Okay, so let's move on to some of the big cyber stories of 2016. First, the reports of hacking in the U.S. presidential election. Now, we know the Democratic presidential candidate Hillary Clinton recently said that Russian hackers went after her campaign because Russian President Vladimir Putin had a personal grudge against her. And then in a wide-ranging press conference last week, Putin said Democrats in Washington are trying to shift blame for their failures in the election. What do we take from all of this about Russia's involvement in this election? What's the main message here?
The main message is when it gets political, it's really hard to do good computer security. Russians didn't hack the elections, and that thing is a bad phrase because when we hear that, we think of hacking the voting machines. And although there was some talk about Pennsylvania, Michigan, Wisconsin, there's no evidence that the vote was hacked, that the machines were hacked, that there was anything other than accurate counting of the vote. Now, there certainly was Russian interference in the election process. We've known that for months. We've been talking about that for months, and that is the hacking of the DNC and other computers, servers, and the release of information. And that's a very different sort of campaign. This is scary. This is foreign influence on our elections. Now, this isn't a new thing. The U.S. did this in Latin America for decades. I mean, it's just new tactics. And it is worrisome because it's very hard to investigate it when it's partisan. So think about a couple of years ago when North Korea attacked Sony. That was big news, but it didn't involve politics, so it could be big news easily. This involves politics. Now suddenly you have congressmen and senators and individuals taking sides depending on who they wanted to be president, and now we have a lot of trouble doing a real investigation. And this is going to be dangerous going forward because the last thing we want is to give the message, which we did, that if you can get away with it for a couple of days after the election, you're going to get away scot-free.
Hmm. What about the connection with WikiLeaks here, which released some of the DNC emails? What do we know about that?
So WikiLeaks publishes stuff they receive.
But not the Republican National Committee emails.
They publish what they receive. They publish everything they receive. Hmm. So WikiLeaks is, in a sense, a tactic. The hackers who attack the DNC use WikiLeaks. If WikiLeaks didn't exist, they would have used half a dozen other mechanisms for publishing. So I wouldn't focus on WikiLeaks because they just happened to be there. Mm-hmm. They weren't essential in the process.
Now, you say there was no evidence about voting machines being tampered with, and yet you've written about your concerns about voting machines. Why is that?
I mean, voting machines are vulnerable, and they will be hacked sooner or later. In this election, they seem to have not been. Doesn't mean they're secure. And I worry about this, you know, for a really important reason. If you think about elections, they serve two purposes. The first one is the obvious one, to choose the winner. And the second is to convince the loser that he lost fairly. Mm-hmm. That hacking, allegations of hacking, are enough to throw election results in turmoil. Now, we in the United States are generally better than that. You know, we've certainly had our problems. But you think about other countries which have more tenuous holds on democracy, a tainted election could easily delegitimize the entire process. So the integrity of the system is vital the integrity of the process.
Mm-hmm. What do you think may have been motivation to raise questions about the integrity of the American process?
Well, you know, that it certainly depends. If you are a foreign country, you might want one of the other candidates to win. I mean, certainly when the United States interferes in elections, that's why we do it. Right? We want one candidate to win. You could just want to put a monkey wrench into the process. Right? You want to mess things up. I mean, there's as many motivations as there are people who want to do this. And interfering in an election, it's not hard to come up with reasons why a person, a country, an organization might want to do it.
What do you think needs to be done to protect the integrity of voting machines? Can we do it?
So I think we can. We have to fall back onto machines we know work. Now, the correct machine is an optical scan machine. My legal residence is Minnesota, and I know we use these machines. I'm not sure what we use in Massachusetts. And this is a piece of paper you vote on. You fill in ovals. That paper is fed into a machine which reads your vote, automatically tabulates it, but stores that paper. And the key is a voter verifiable paper ballot. And if we do that, we can much, much more effectively ensure the integrity of the voting process. Right? This is not speaking of the networks of the candidates and all everything that's coming before, but that's what we need to do. These touchscreen machines are very vulnerable, the computerized machines. So it's really moving back to more secure, less automated technology. And I would like to see a permanent bureaucracy in charge of the vote in the United States. Other countries have this. You know, we have a very ad hoc partisan system, and that just makes it harder to deal with things that come up. Because if you think about it, 2 weeks before the election, it's easy to come up with rules about what to do in case of problems, because no one knows who the problems will fall on. It's just after the fact, the battle lines are drawn, and you can't step back and figure out the right thing to do. So more planning, better voting machines. You know, we really do need to secure candidate networks. Now, in a lot of ways, politics is propaganda, right? It's my message versus your message. So it's almost hard to stop foreign interference, because what's the difference? And one side will welcome it because it'll be on their side. But I want us to do better at trying to keep our elections inside our borders. I don't think the country is served well if foreign powers can put the finger on the scales in any direction.
So I want to talk about more automated here and the so-called Internet of Things. You testified before Congress about this. Explain just very briefly what that is exactly.
So the Internet of Things is a term we use for all those computerized everythings we're getting. Right, so your smartphone. I have a internet-enabled thermostat. If you have a new refrigerator or a television or a baby monitor, many of these are on the internet. And more things are becoming computerized. You can buy an internet-enabled Barbie doll. You can buy an internet-enabled coffee machine. And you might wonder why you might want one of those. It seems odd. But, you know, the younger you are, the more use there is for some of these new internet-enabled devices. And we worry about the security of them. Mm-hmm. Because these things, unlike your computers, affect the world in a direct physical manner. So what we're doing is we're giving the internet the capability to do things. If it's a medical device, if it's an automobile, to potentially kill people. And when I was talking before Congress, one of the things I said is that there's a fundamental difference between your spreadsheet crashes and you lose your data, and your car crashes and you lose your life. Mm-hmm. That even though it's the same computer, the same operating system, maybe even the same programs, the effects are night and day different. And we have to get used to a world where our computers can harm us. And I believe that's going to change everything.
Yeah, it would seem also you're telling companies that they have to prepare for a world where they have to be concerned about some of the risks in their products as they also have to be concerned about their bottom line.
And that's the way we work. I mean, if you build a product that can kill somebody, a medical device, a pharmaceutical, an airplane, there are different rules that we as a society put around you. There are rules about licensing, about certifications, I mean, lots of different government standards, because what you're making is dangerous. And in computers, we've been used to decades of you can do whatever you want, because it didn't really matter. Because as bad as things could be, nobody's dying. And that's changing. So I think companies will have different rules as producers and then also as consumers of these devices, because now they're also going to be worried about the effects of the thermostats in there that they are buying. About a couple months ago, there was a big attack against networks in, I believe, Finland, which affected computer-controlled thermostats in that country, which could mean burst pipes and property damage. Right? That just wasn't possible 5 years ago.
Mm. And, of course, the big device is smartphones. And there was a big debate this past year between the FBI and Apple over one of the smartphones used by the terrorists in the San Bernardino attacks, getting access to that data. You've written that going forward, you expect a renewed call from the FBI for backdoors into people's smartphones. What does that entail exactly?
Well, it's unfortunate, and this really has to do with the FBI's myopic view of the world. They are in charge of solving crimes. So they want things to be easier for solving crimes. They're not going to take a broader view. And in the San Bernardino case, they wanted Apple to basically make every phone they sell less secure so they would be able to break into the phones of suspected criminals. Now, that is a trade-off that we as a society have to make. I mean, do we want the phones that our, I don't know, people who run our nuclear power plants, our congressmen, do we want those phones to be less secure in order to make a particular FBI forensic technique easier? I would like us to recognize that a secure phone is vital for our national security, and that the FBI needs other tools for crime prevention, detection, for forensics, than breaking into a phone. Now, the bigger picture is the phone we all carry is an enormous surveillance device. Mm-hmm. It knows where we all are, because it can't ring unless it knows where we are. It knows who we talk to, it knows our messages, it knows our emails, our contacts, our calendar. If you think about what's in our phone, they are incredibly intimate surveillance devices. And we've put them in everybody's hands, you know, for valid business reasons, but now you have the easy makings of a totalitarian state.
Mm-hmm.
And countries like China are using all of this to increase tyranny.
So, in the last minute and a half we have left here, I'm wondering, what are the major recommendations you would give to someone to try to protect their data and their privacy in this age of ubiquitous devices and possible foreign state interference?
Yeah, and this is a problem. There's not a lot you can do, because most of your data is not in your hands. 10 years ago, I could tell you to protect your computer. But now, your email is on Gmail, your photos are on some photo site, your documents are in the cloud, everything is elsewhere. You might be using Yahoo, which just had an enormous data breach, and you just had your data there. I mean, a lot of it is we need to agitate for better laws and better systems, because we've built a tech system where most of your security is not under your control. Right? That internet thermostat that I have in my home, I can't secure it. I mean, I have to trust the company that made it.
Okay.
So either I don't have it, or I trust the companies.
Bruce Schneier, security analyst and fellow at the Berkman Center for Internet and Society at Harvard. Thanks again for being with us.
Hey, thank you.
Stay with us. There's more ahead. I'm Deborah Becker, and this is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Deborah Becker.
Poor soul, spit upon that poor soul.
David Bowie fans should recognize this song. It's a cover of A Small Plot of Land from Bowie's 1995 album, Outside.
And it hit him so
And this cover has special significance. It's by the Donny McCaslin Group, the featured band on David Bowie's final album, Black Star.
The vibe's left. The fool is dead.
Black Star is nominated for a number of Grammys, including Best Alternative Music Album. The McCaslin Group has their own album, titled Beyond Now. It was released in the fall and influenced by David Bowie. This past August, saxophonist Donny McCaslin joined us in studio to talk about the album. We began by talking about the group's cover of A Small Plot of Land, featuring guest vocalist Jeff Taylor.
Thrill of your life. Standing so near to innocent eyes, all dance. Swings through the tunnels and claws his way. He swears like so many.
Donny McCaslin, why did you choose this song to cover?
I think, in a way, it just touched me when I heard it, and I could hear us doing an adaption that would be interesting. You know, he has such a huge discography, and there's so much to choose from. And, you know, as I was just scanning through things, my producer, David Binney, sent this one over with a few other tunes, and I remember hearing it and just feeling right away like, okay, yeah, this is something we can work with. And I could hear us, hear my voice on this tune and the band doing an interesting adaption.
Mm. So much emotion, which I have to wonder whether and how much a sense of mourning played into your selection of the songs because of what had happened to David Bowie.
Yeah, it's you know, tough for me to talk about, but especially...
I'm sorry.
No, it's okay. Mm-hmm. Especially Warsaw, because we were about to play a week-long engagement at Village Vanguard in January. I think this was the third week of January. And, you know, everything had just happened, and it was such a difficult time emotionally. And we were talking about wanting to pay tribute to David. What was the best way to do it? What would feel appropriate? And Jason Lindner, our keyboard player, suggested Warsaw, and we played it at the sound check, and then we ended up playing it every set of the week, every set of that week, and it just felt like it felt emotionally cathartic to have that song to funnel all these feelings through. Mm. So that was the beginning, and that was the one they said, well, you know, would love to record this, record our version of it. And then that led to A Small Plot of Land. And then the overall thing with the record, even as I started writing the music in the summer, a lot of the music from Black Star and David's music was kind of running in my mind. And he was just an exceptional person and artist. And making Black Star and working with him was a profound experience for me and the band. So I wanted to just pay tribute to him.
Right. Now, the title track of your album is also inspired by a song of Bowie's that you recorded, right? During
yes.
the Black Star sessions, but it didn't make it.
I mean, David, he wrote a lot of great songs for Black Star that didn't make the record. And this was one of them. I don't know what the title is, but it was one of the first songs he sent me, and just very strong. And it was actually the first tune that we recorded when we started working on Black Star. So again, I was just sitting at the piano, and that was running through my... A couple of the general themes of that song was running through my head, and I tried to let that be a foundation for my song.
Hmm. How did you meet David Bowie?
Well, it was through Maria Schneider, who I've played with for many years, and she was collaborating with David on a song called Sue, on a version of that with her big band, which I'm a part of. And when she was meeting with him, she suggested to him that he do something with me. And she played him a record of mine called Casting for Gravity. And that's sort of what what started it, evidently. I think she suggested it again, and then she brought David down to hear us play at the 55 Bar, this little club in New York City. And it was about a week after that where I met him for the first time at the first rehearsal for Sue, which was just a stripped-down version of Maria's band. It was Mark Giuliana, actually, the drummer from my group, who had recommended to Maria for this, and Jay Anderson, Ryan Keverly, myself, David, Maria, and Tony Visconti, David's longtime producer. So that's where we met for the first time. We started talking, and he asked me for my email address, which seems funny to us, you know. But it was, you know.
Were you shocked?
I mean, I had an inkling because Maria had been telling me about their conversation. So I had an inkling that that something might happen. But still, it seemed surreal to be meeting him and everything. But he was so wonderful and so present when we were together. And, you know, even though he was this icon and major star, you know, you just felt really at ease with him. Just a wonderful person.
Well, I want to make sure we get a little bit of music in. Let's play a little bit of the saxophone from David Bowie's Black Star. Let's listen. Very nice. Very nice. Donnie McCaslin, tell us about that collaboration process and how the saxophone solo. What were you thinking when this was happening?
Well, I think I was really trying to immerse myself in his music. And he had sent me demos before the Black Star sessions. And I just felt like I didn't really know what to expect in the studio. I worked with him on Maria's song, but Maria was conducting that session. It was with her big band. It was what I was used to. So I didn't know sort of how things would go. So I just tried to really know every song as deeply as I could, and then was trying to play from that place of knowing the song and trying to serve the music, I guess you would say. He was very passionate, and he sang with a lot of conviction. And I know that emotion was inspiring me to play. And that's, I think, kind of one of the things that I go to as a musician is I go for emotional expression. And so I felt, you know, in my group, a lot of what we do as improvisers is feed ideas off each other, and there's a lot of conversational stuff happening. And he stepped right into that. We were doing it now within the framework of his songs, but he really participated in that. As we were throwing ideas to each other, he was also, you know, pushing us and stuff. So it was really fun. Mm. You know, it was really, really inspiring. So I guess I remember when we played that, I think that was the first take of that song, and I was just kind of thinking about the song. And not trying to come in with an agenda of like, well, I've practiced this and I can do this on the saxophone and I can play this. I tried to let go of all of that and just be in the moment, the way that I saw him being in the moment as an artist. And I just wanted to just play the music that was presented to me.
Was it difficult at all when you were working with him to sort of try to maintain your own voice? You know what I mean? Well, you could be easily overshadowed by a David Bowie, and it sounds like he didn't want that to happen, but how do you sort of make sure it doesn't?
Right? Yeah, I mean, I guess the thing was it was my band, and we have so much history together going into that helped. It wasn't like I was just a hired gun coming in to play a couple solos. Mm-hmm. You know, it was this group, and we know each other, we played, we traveled together, so we have our language already coming into that, and I think that really helped. And then also David was really, couldn't have been more open to any suggestion I might have or anything I wanted to try. He set the environment at the very beginning of like, let's just go for this. Let's see what happens. Let's not worry about what, style of music this is. Let's have a good time and let's do this. So I think it was a combination of those factors. I felt pretty at ease and felt like I could express myself. On some of the songs I had, orchestrated some of the horn parts with different woodwinds that I play and added little things, and he was totally open to it, and as was Tony. And I think as we went on day by day and seeing how happy they were with what we were doing, that was also a sense of affirmation of like, yeah, this is cool. They're into it. Like, great.
Right.
Just gonna go for it.
How do you think all of that's affected this new album?
Well, it's the relationships deepened in my band because of Black Star, just musically and because of everything that happened. So I think that's one thing that has really affected the new record, is just this deeper sense of connection within the band, deeper sense of interplay. I think in terms of the songs that I wrote, just on a deeper level in terms of giving the guys room to express themselves, better songs, and again, I just think because of everything that happened, this record, there's a sense of emotional catharsis about it when we were making it, and I wanted it to reflect the feelings of everything that had happened. So, and I'm grateful for the opportunity to do that.
I want to listen to a little bit more of Black Star. This is the track Lazarus, and I think it's a good example of some jazz influence here. Mm-hmm. Let's listen.
This way or no way.
That's the song Lazarus from David Bowie's final album, Black Star, featuring the Donny McCaslin Group. Donny McCaslin, when you hear these songs now, when you hear this album, do you have a greater appreciation? What does it feel like now that it's all together?
I feel like it was a really special experience that'll stay with me for the rest of my life. And hearing the record is I'm really proud of the way it sounds. I'm proud to be a part of it, and I marvel at his vision for putting these songs together, the way he wrote these songs. I'm grateful to him for entrusting us, with being a part of it. It was just tremendous. I mean, I don't listen to the album a lot because of all the feelings involved, but when I do, I really enjoy it, and I think he sounds so great on it, and the lyrics are so profound.
Did you have any idea he was that ill?
It's something that I don't talk about.
Okay.
Yeah.
So, what do you hope to do in terms of the future and collaborations in the future?
Well, I'm interested to see what might happen. I mean, I'm very happy with how Beyond Now turned out. And in the immediate future, there's a lot of touring with that record. And Jeff Taylor, who sang on A Small Plot of Land, is a great singer, and we're talking about a collaboration. And there might be some other possibilities. So I think I am looking towards, some sort of collaboration with my group, with a vocalist or a group of vocalists, and just see what could happen that way in terms of songwriting. But really, I just am enjoying having the opportunity to play and develop music with my group.
That's saxophonist Donnie McCaslin of the Donnie McCaslin Group. We spoke with him in August. The group's latest album is Beyond Now, and it's dedicated to David Bowie. We'll go out today with the title track from the album. Radio Boston is a production of 90.9 WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. I'm Deborah Becker. This is Radio Boston.